Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording
live from FYP Studios, Houston.
Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 197 of Registry Matters. Larry, where are we at?
We're in Houston, Texas, at the NARSL National Conference.
Have you, do you have any just opening thoughts, something interesting that you witnessed in the last couple of days?
Well, I had someone educate me about something I was wrong on again.
Wait, I need a calendar. What were you wrong about?
Well, we did a piece of legislation in 2013 in New Mexico that did a lot of good stuff for PFRs, but you never get anything that's totally for PFRs, and we had a provision in there that I thought was good enough, but he informed me that it said something that I didn't even remember that was in there. And I said, no, it doesn't say that. I wrote the damn thing. I know what it says. And so he pulled up the statute and he showed it. He says, well, actually, it does say that.
Do you want to elaborate?
Well, it was regarding the people who moved to New Mexico from other states. So anybody who moves after 2013 who's been convicted after 2013, not who moves there, they potentially might have to register under the terms of what they had in the state they came from. That's not what we intended, but you could, since the law is subject to interpretation, you could interpret it that way. So, but he doesn't understand, most people don't, in the flying fury of closing legislative days when most of the bills pass and are acted upon, things happen so quickly. Like, you can't get something passed unless you'll agree to amendments. So we often write amendments up on paper. One side will say, if you'll put this language in it. So the sponsor will come back and say, what do you think about that language? And I say, briefly, we can go with that. And then that's when the negotiations end. We send it up to the fourth floor to be drafted by legislative council so it can come down into printed form. And they vote on the bill as amended. So the language, people think it goes days and days. Sometimes it's just literally minutes when language is changed. And like I looked at it and I said, this will work. Well, it may not work as well as I thought, but I am right about one thing. It has never been used the way he thinks it is used. But that doesn't mean it couldn't be at some point. But we don't apply it the way that he's in the most negative possible light. It could be applied. And I told him that. I said, you have spotted something that if someone who was really trying to apply the law in the most disastrous way that could be imagined, it could be interpreted that way, because the law is often not as clear as you think. We have differences of opinion. He thinks it says that. I know I didn't intend it to say that, but someone else may think it says that as well.
So I need we need to get the FYP administrative staff on board so that we can catalog this is the day that you learned that you did something wrong?
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far.
Oh, I see.
I would say that I did not. See, we always think about unintended consequences, and we think very carefully, but sometimes you cannot imagine everything. You have a 30-day session, you have a 60-day session, you've got 600, 700 bills, and they're moving quickly, particularly in the final 2 weeks, and things like that happen. It doesn't work the way most people think it does. You know, it's like we don't keep these things going for months and months and months in small states. Your sessions are short. I think even Texas has a relatively short session every other year. And it doesn't work the way people think. You know, that in Congress, they see them running year-round except for these long recesses and holidays and in the summer. But in the smaller populated states, not that way.
We are in Houston, as we said in the intro, and we have a room full of hundreds of people. Y'all can laugh now if you want to. See, they're really here, Larry. There's hundreds of people. There's a line out the door actually going around. There's bicycle cops circling the building. So we have security. Is everybody enjoying the conference?
Yes.
How many people are here for the first time? I can't hear you.
Yes.
Okay, good. Jeepers. So for me, what I thought was one of the most interesting things, I'm all about some like cognitive biases logical fallacies. And one of them is called the Dunning-Kruger effect. And Paul Dubling today described it and goes, so you got to picture a bridge. And when you know nothing, you think you know more. And when you know a lot, you realize how much more you actually need to know. And Paul Dubling said, I am probably the most educated person in North Carolina on these laws, and I realize how little I know about the laws. And I was like, he just pointed out Dunning-Kruger. And I thought it was amazing.
Yep.
Anybody else? Anybody want to just shout out, who is your favorite speaker?
Kathleen.
Yeah. Who is Kathleen?
Kathleen Hambrick.
Oh, and what did she do? What did Kathleen Hambrick do?
Well, she represents Cage. So she...
She represents Cage.
She spoke out about sexting operations and basically how it's just the money-making scam that our government is running.
And we may have Kathleen join us here in a little while, and she can give us an overview and a rundown of what went on. I thought it was an amazing presentation. Just saying. Did you observe this, Larry?
I didn't get to observe that one.
All right, let the flogging begin. What are we going to do tonight, Larry?
I don't know yet. We're on the fly. We usually have a much more scripted program, but we're going to be talking about polygraphs with a person who knows probably more about litigation than anyone in the room related to polygraphs. He's a precedential case out of the 10th Circuit, Brian Von Behring. And even though we had forgotten it, it's the second time he's been with us.
So. We were sitting at the table with Brian, and he was like, man, dude, this would be awesome. You're here. We can go over your case on the podcast. And he goes, we did it like a year ago. I seriously still, even listening to it, I don't remember this. It was episode 160?
I think so, yeah.
It was either 160 or 161, and it was recorded in January of this year. It's not even like it was that long ago, and I was like, yeah, Larry, we did this.
So we have Brian, and we have possibly some questions. I've been speaking with people here, and one that really intrigues me, because I get the question in writing a lot, since I am on the board of directors of NARSOL, and I'm the publisher of the newsletter, and I'm the legal coordinator, I get a lot of questions. And we take a lot of them on the podcast from people who write from prisons. And so I got a question about a loved one who cannot have access to email. And then I started talking around because we hear that question all the time. Then I have attorneys concerned about time limits running out about filing things because the communication, though some of those timelines are pretty tight. So I don't have the answers, but maybe we can shed more light on it and figure out how to move forward towards what we can do to solve the problem about the blanket restriction related to people who are serving time in federal prisons. And it even seems to be hit and miss depending on which prison you're in. So hopefully that person can stay around long enough and we can get into that a little bit more. But yeah, and then other people may have questions. We always welcome questions. They're usually coming in by, he said, don't tap the table.
So. Don't tap the table.
And I already did it once. So
you did it, and you were like almost
so
like
I realized he just got through telling everybody not to do that. Why am I? So I put my hands under here.
I had to squelch the drinking cadre in the back, and you're up here tapping on the table.
That's us.
Yes. Have fun. So we are going to have a little conversation for the first or second time with Mr. Von Behring about the Colorado case that occurred sometime in the middle 2010s, right? 2015, 2016, not really sure when.
Yeah, I was. I think the decision was 2016. I should have looked it up before I went up here. But the process was 2015, 2016.
And you gave a similar answer when we asked you about it before, so no further research has been done.
No.
Okay. What were the conditions? It has something to do with pleading the Fifth and taking a polygraph, correct?
Yeah. So my case involved a required sex offender history polygraph that was given to me while I was in treatment. Involved the full packet, a lot of the stuff you guys talked about a few episodes ago on the call-in show, which is great. And yeah, I had to take the full packet home and fill it out and did all that. And at the same time, had already kind of been talking with public defender about some post-conviction stuff and brought up the issue of the polygraph and, you know, basically wanted to push it, you know, and see how far I could kind of, you know, force the treatment provider's hand to either allow me to not take it or to, you know, do what they were threatening, which was to kick me out of treatment, but do it in a way where I would be protected from being revoked for my supervised release.
Is it fair to ask what the question was? Do you even know?
I do. They, the ones they submitted to the court, there were four or five questions. I don't remember the exact wording, but all of them except for one would have implicated a criminal offense if I had answered affirmatively to them. I personally didn't really have too much to worry about with it, but didn't think they should be asking the questions regardless. But they involved if you had any sexual contact with anyone under the age of 18, if you had any sexual contact with anyone who was asleep or unconscious. I think one of them involved, I think one of them was about incest, if you had any incestuous contact. And there was another one that was also in place, I think illegal. I think it was position of trust or something similar for there.
Okay.
And then there was one general one. Well, one of the questions they also asked, which they inadvertently got put on the record, was, is there anything else or have you committed any other criminal offense that you haven't told us about? And they admitted that that was actually a control question and that would be taken off. But the other ones were relevant questions.
Is the polygraph a reliable way of determining truth or fiction?
Depends who you ask. My opinions are a little different than I think some people I've talked to, I think, including you. I think there is some validity to it. I'll be upfront about that.
You think there's validity in the actual device or that it extracts a confession?
I think that when it is used in a way where the person receiving it does not know how it works, and there's a key deception there that's critical to it,
okay,
that when that deception is unknown by the person taking it, that there it's better than a 50-50 in determining if someone was answering a question truthfully or not.
But that's because you've scared the person into them believing that the Kabuki machine works, and then they confess.
I would say even if you're just asking someone a question that was not in the confessional part of it, it's just a straight up question, that it would be better than just a straight coin flip. That there is, how accurate, I don't know. I have seen some studies, but I think that the polygraph has changed somewhat from the way it was used, 20, 30 years ago. And at least all of the polygraphs that I took and the ones I've talked to from other people in sex offender treatment they're often graded by a computer algorithm with the polygrapher kind of, being able to override that. But they're based on some physiological responses that I think are real.
Okay. So back to the case side. Larry, why don't you take over and start digging into extracting more information about this case?
Well, when you realized that you were going to potentially have an issue with a polygraph, I don't think we covered those on the podcast. How did you get the ball rolling? What happened that inspired you to take the action that you took? The PO called and said, be at the polygraph office tomorrow morning? How did that go down?
Yeah, so I had a bit of some interactions before that. When I was released from the BOP, still in the custody of the BOP, I entered treatment in a community corrections center. And that's when the history polygraph questionnaire started. I knew something that was upcoming. During that process, I was terminated from treatment for a host of some, in my opinion, some fairly minor things, such as receiving a card from a family member who was a minor that said happy birthday on it, third-party contact, and a couple other things. And I was, back essentially for a month or so in a holding facility and had access to the law library and started looking out ways that I could fight any of the treatment conditions that I knew were going to be coming up, in another month or so. And one of those was the history polygraph. And I had done some legal research before and was somewhat familiar with it, so kind of wrote up some information to an attorney. And I was fortunate in that the Federal Public Defender's Office was able to continue to represent me and gave some information to my attorney and kind of confirmed some things with him. And I had a little bit of a prepared. And then inevitably I was, put back into treatment and had a lot of conversations back and forth with the treatment provider and, whether or not they're going to force it. And at one point they were trying to arrange immunity. That was one of the ways they could have essentially forced me to, is if they offered both federal and state immunity to anything I said, and that ended up being something that was, in their words, impossible. And so at that point, I was ordered to take it. I refused. We appealed to district judge. The district judge sided with the prosecution, the probation office, and the treatment provider. And we appealed, asked for a stay of that order. And in the parking lot, right before I was walking in to actually take the examination and, you know, assert my Fifth Amendment right, and I assume at that point probably revoked, the Tenth Circuit issued their stay and you know, said that I didn't
have
to.
That's where I was trying to get with it, because people ask me all the time, what can I do? What did Von Behren do? And I said, well, I really don't know. Didn't represent him. But people want to know when the real mechanics of when they said take it, because I don't want to ever tell anyone to refuse, because I don't want someone to go on handcuffs because I said so. So that machination from when you were told to take it, you just flat out refused and said, I'm not going to take it? Or did you narrow down that rejection and say, I can't answer certain questions?
Right, and that was in the court proceedings initially. I told the court that I would not answer the incriminating questions.
When they told you to go take the polygraph, I'm trying to get at that. PO calls and says, you've got a polygraph scheduled Wednesday of next week. Mm-hmm. Did you say, I ain't going to take it? Or did you say, what did you do mechanically? What did you do?
No, I told them that I was going to take it with my lawyer present and that I was going to assert my Fifth Amendment right to any incriminating questions they asked.
I seem to recall, Larry, you saying that, like, you can do that.
But it's not going to go well. And so you just flat out said, I'll take it with my lawyer present.
Correct.
And your lawyer agreed to be present.
Yes. And they told me that he was going to have to be, he couldn't be in the room, but he could be observing from another room. And if I really wanted, if he could give me a break to go talk with him, but that would have to reset the machine. And they made it sound like it would be an onerous process.
So you're at this polygraph examination, and I've taken a few of them. So they got you all wired up, right?
Well, I was prepared for that. The Tenth Circuit issued their stay while we were walking into the polygraph office.
So I actually didn't go in there.
And once the Tenth Circuit issued the stay, because the polygrapher had already said they weren't going to be able to change the questions to be non-incriminating, right? They refused to do that.
Do me a favor, back up though. So there's a gap in the story. Larry's saying you get told that you're going to take the polygraph.
You have to go fork out
the 225, 250, whatever that number was. Somewhere in there, you contacted counsel to then start running things up the flagpole.
Yeah.
Before they issue a stay.
Because I want to tell people what they can do when the PO calls and says, go take a polygraph. I want to mimic what you did.
If it's repeatable. If it's not repeatable.
It is. And the way it works in Colorado now as a result of this, and I think in a lot of other places, is that my case addresses a little bit, the Fifth Amendment privilege, in some contexts, can be self-executing. In the context of self of sex history polygraphs, it's not. You have to affirmatively raise it. And you can't refuse to take a polygraph just because it's a polygraph or just because they might ask you incriminating questions. What you can do, at least in the Tenth Circuit, is you can plead the Fifth to any question they ask you that implicates a new criminal offense. And that can either be something you believe is a new criminal offense, or if you really have an attorney present, that an attorney tells you is. But you have to go, you have to show up. Once they actually ask you the question, either in the pre-interview phase, I imagine that would be when you would do it, right, before you actually hooked up the machine, you say, I'm not going to, you know, they say, here's the question, you know, is there anything you want to tell me? And you say, I'm not going to answer that question at all. I'm not going to give you information under the Fifth Amendment.
So you were at a polygraph exam and they asked you the questions. That's when you said Fifth Amendment?
Yeah, and in my case, this all for me specifically, it didn't go that far, because the polygrapher and the treatment provider had already said that they weren't going to change those questions. And I had already said that I'm going to plead the Fifth to them. And they already said, well, if you do that, we're going to kick you out of treatment and revoke you.
Right.
And so the stay we requested was to temporarily not allow them to require me to take a polygraph exam. And that's the Tenth Circuit issued that stay. So
from the time that you were told to take it, you did not take one at that point because you said, I'm not going to answer these questions. I'm going to plead the Fifth.
Mm-hmm.
So you do get revoked. You get kicked out of treatment at that point or no?
I got kicked out of treatment once the Tenth Circuit issued their stay, once it was settled, right? It was still up in the air. They didn't really know.
How long does this take, though?
About 3 months.
So for 3 months, they let you just kind of slide
yeah.
without?
Well, I'm still confused
because normally you get the test, you do the pre-interview, that's when they give you the questions because the PO and all these people have developed supposedly some questions. Your sexual history is kind of straightforward, but you knew the questions because who had given them to you, because normally you don't know the questions until you get there. So how did you know what you were objecting to when you hadn't seen the questions?
That information came out in my challenge to them at the district level. The person who was going to get the polygraph exam came in and put on the record the questions they were going to ask me. And you're right, that part is not standard. Because there's this huge packet you fill out, and they can ask you any question on there. But there was a little bit of some back and forth, and some things actually got miscommunicated that officially became part of the district record, but they put on the record the questions they were going to ask me at that point.
So you were on your way in to take your polygraph, and the order came down. And it was stopped.
It was stopped, yeah.
That is amazing. I mean, that happens so infrequently.
Yeah, it was literally like in the parking lot. My lawyer gets a phone call and, you know, just gives me a look. And I think, I don't know, probably a little high five there or something. But, yeah.
Were you able to find an attorney that would represent you pro bono? Or are you independently wealthy?
Public defender.
It was the same public defender who represented me in my original
thing.
And because it was, so all of this started, it's kind of funny, the reason why the public defender was able to represent me was because this started initially with the probation department.
I have somebody in the audience checking the sound to make sure that was working.
The probation department sought to modify my conditions of supervised release to require me to stay in a halfway house for an extra 6 months. And I refused to sign the paper saying I waived my rights to a hearing. And they did not like that at all. And they threatened stuff, you're going to be homeless, all this kind of other stuff. But because I refused, they had an emergency motion the day I was going to be released from custody to modify my conditions so that I had to go to halfway house. And at that point, because it was now, you know, a hearing as part of my sentence, they appointed me a public defender. And it was the same public defender that had represented me, you know, a decade ago.
So, well, for anyone who doesn't practice law, that's an amazing story. The courts are so hesitant to intervene on any type of supervision stuff. And the fact that he can get the Court of Appeals, which we only have 11 of those in the United States, it's pretty important to have a case acted on and have an injunction issued. Because the standard of review, when we talk about legal cases, there's a standard of review. And most everything is called a standard review of abuse of discretion. And I would, without remembering the case specifically, I believe that would have been an abuse of discretion decision, a standard of review. And for the Tenth Circuit to take that strong of a position saying, we're going to stop this preemptively is amazing. I mean, it really is. And now the whole Tenth Circuit, however many states, I never can remember, but eight, whatever it is in the Tenth Circuit.
Sure.
This is something that can be cited as precedential. So if you live in the Tenth Circuit and they're giving you a polygraph where you can incriminate yourself, it can't be just because you don't like the polygraph. But if you are risking incriminating a criminal, having a criminal charge, thanks to, and his lawyer, Brian, we've got some good case law in the Tenth Circuit. And it's actually come back to help us in Utah, and I don't know where else, because I don't know every case that's out there, but it has been utilized successfully.
Larry, I have been informed that there is, from our covert staff here, that there is someone that has a question asked. Please do me a favor and come up in here on this edge of the wall, because the microphone won't pick you up from way in the back. And if you want to say a real name or not a real name, but just give me a first name and then go ahead. I think that'll be fine. I think. Yeah, I mean, can you get sort of close to the picture and go ahead?
Okay, so my name's R.S. Helly. So my question is, because you were talking about how you complete the Fifth, What about if you are being forced to lie and not provide your real truthful answer? Can you use a Fifth for that? Or how does that work?
What would be the conditions that they're asking you to tell a false narrative?
Well, for example, in my son's case, it's one of these sexting operation cases, and the question was going to be, did you show up to have sex with a minor? And his answer is a firm no.
Oh, because he didn't believe that he was there to have sex with a minor, right?
Right. His intention was not to have sex with a minor.
Right.
He was not going to... That's not why he showed up. He actually did believe it was a minor, but his intention was not to... he is one of the ones that did believe it was a minor, but his intention was not to have sex with a minor. And it's too much to explain. He doesn't have previous sexual experience, blah, 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 whatever. Anyway, his answer is a firm no. Well, he's not allowed to answer that, and he's being punished for that now. He was made to pay $250 for his polygraph. He showed up to take it. He did not refuse to take it. He refused to lie, and he said the answer is going to be no, and they knew that ahead of time. He said, I'm going to want my results and the recording for my lawyer. So then they backed out of giving him the polygraph, and he got kicked out of treatment, of course, and now he's facing revocation.
This sounds similar. Jill Levinson brought it up briefly, that while you're in treatment, if you actually are innocent, but then your treatment provider says, I need you to admit guilt, but I'm not guilty of anything, and now the treatment provider says, you can't stay here, and now you've been kicked out of treatment. And that would probably be a probation violation.
Yes. So my question is, does a fifth not apply in that case?
Larry?
It's too hard for me to even go there. I totally understand the question, and it's not a new question. I've heard that before.
Really?
They want me to lie because I go in and I tell them the truth, and that's not what they want to hear. I didn't, particularly for a person who didn't do anything at all. They were falsely accused. But once they stand convicted, then a condition of treatment is acceptance of responsibility. As far as the law is concerned, you are a convicted person. You did that because the jury of your peers, or you admitted you did it, one or the other, you're convicted. So therefore, if you say you didn't do it and you're a convicted person, you're lying.
So he was terrified that he would fail the polygraph if he did lie. So I guess, can we agree that the polygraph is not legit then? Because they would have just
you're not going to get any disagreement out of me. Because like the statements that you're making further support that it is the big giant kabuki machine. Because if they need you to say a specific thing, then it's not an unbiased, it's not a double blind anything. It's complete smoke and mirrors. But if you do believe that it works, and if the thing goes when you say the wrong thing, then yeah, it worked. Same as if the doctor puts on the white coat and says, here's your aspirin, and he just handed you a sugar pill. And now you're, yeah, my aches and pains are gone. It's the exact same thing. It's a placebo.
Because if it were real, they would have allowed him to answer with his response.
Sure.
And then they could have shown, okay, you failed, you're lying. But they didn't even bother giving him the polygraph after that.
We're going to get to these stories in a little bit. Thank you for that. We've never covered that kind of question.
Yeah, it's not unusual for people to say, I'm going to get kicked out of treatment for telling the truth.
I lied for 20 years on the polygraph test.
Yeah.
And never got violated. It's just that easy. I mean, for me, maybe I'm a natural liar. I don't know, but, you know.
But you do kind of have that look.
You do have that look.
It's all about distraction.
Right, and I don't know if... I think I said this on the polygraph on one of the shows, is that a friend of mine told me that he would have a friend come over and give him a polygraph. Now, Larry, where were you last night? Were you doing anything? And so now in his mind, he's like, well, I had a polygraph last night. So he goes in to see the polygrapher today and they go, well, since your last polygraph, have you done it? Well, in my mind, I had a polygraph 12 hours ago. So I'm not lying to you. And I was like, that's really clever. But there again, it's all about the mind game here of the kabuki machine, and it's complete bunk. Just saying, we don't have to rehash that whole thing. We did a whole episode on the kabuki machine.
So Brian, would you try to clarify to people, because all the time, Georgia, you remember your buddy in Georgia that was part of the advocacy group there, that his mother, or wasn't a mother, it was another advocate that said that since Von Behring came down that people don't have to take a polygraph. And I said, you go ahead and do that and find out what happens.
He refused outright everything and not. So my understanding is that you can refuse to answer that question or that question, but you can't go, I plead the fifth and I'm not answering anything. And that's what this guy did. After your case came out and I was brand new into advocacy, he just said, I'm going to go sit in jail and F you people. I'm not taking the polygraph because I plead the fifth. And I don't think, I don't know what happened to him, but I don't think it went well.
You don't advocate that approach, do you?
No, not at all. There's some amount of subjective in your mind, right? Like, if you're taking the polygraph, you're not an attorney. And so, but it's usually pretty easy to tell if the question they're asking you is implicating a criminal offense or if it would just be something that could get you in trouble, but for probation, revocation, or treatment violation, or something like that. There's a very, very clear line between those two things, and all the courts that have issued opinions on the polygraph have all come the same way, which is that questions that implicate probation violations, technical violations, treatment violations are allowed. They can require you to answer them, and that you are welcome to refuse, but if you do, there is no protections on them from terminating you from treatment or revoking your probation for not answering those.
Would an example be something like, so we are crystal clear, as Nixon used to say, perfectly clear, when they say, did you violate your curfew? That is not a criminal offense. That is a legitimate question, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But if they say, I'll give you another legitimate, have you looked at any stimulating sexual pictures? That is a broad question, and you should actually ask for that to be refined, because you could be looking at legal porn if you were not under supervision, and that wouldn't subject you to a criminal charge. But if they say, have you looked at anyone's picture that's under the age of 18, then you're potentially facing a new criminal charge. So you have to be particularly concerned about what you refuse to answer, or you're going to find yourself behind bars. I mean, you agree with that?
Yes. No, for sure. And usually in the context, there's two typical types of exams, right? There's the sex history polygraphs, which usually occur at the beginning and are, you know, are limited in number, one or two sometimes. And then there's the maintenance polygraph exams. Generally, they don't ask you questions on the maintenance exams that would implicate you in a new criminal offense. And if they do, you are usually able to get them reworded in such a way to limit them or expand them sometimes, you know, to not implicate a new criminal offense. So, for instance, I talked to someone who, in all of his maintenance exams, would get asked, have you viewed any child pornography in the last, you know, since the last exam? And he would say, I'm not going to answer that, but if you ask me if I viewed any pornography, just like you said, and since in the last 6 months, I will answer that. And they would actually broaden the question, right, and make it so that it was implicating a criminal offense, and then they would ask him, and he would answer it, and, you know, and pass the polygraph.
Do you have a question?
Yes, Mike from New Jersey. Quick question is, can the polygraph examiner force you to try to answer a question if they just say, oh, it's a control question, the answer doesn't matter?
So there are three types of questions they'll ask on a polygraph exam. There are relevant questions, control questions, and irrelevant ones. Irrelevant ones. The entire reason why the polygraph machine works at all is because they intentionally try to get you to confuse the control questions with the irrelevant ones. If they ask you and they say you have to answer this question, are you sitting down? Is your name John? Those kinds of questions. And they tell you they want you to answer them. They're trying to convince you that those are the control questions, and they absolutely are not. Those questions are completely irrelevant for the scoring. They are said only to convince you that there is some legitimacy to the machine and that you somehow answering those is giving it some kind of more control. The real control questions are ones that you don't know are, and that once you do realize they're control questions, completely invalid is what makes, you know, it trivial to pass a polygraph.
Do they actually bring up the word legitimatize the polygraph? Because I would end up laughing. I would straight up laugh.
I mean, it's part of the training that the polygraphers receive. They want you, the person taking it, to believe that it is legitimate so that it builds it up. And they also want you to believe that the real control questions they're asking are questions that you have some reaction to. And they need you to have a reaction to the real control questions. Otherwise, they can't score it at all.
So all retired FBI agents test for 25 years and things like that. You know, so.
Yeah, there's a really great resource called The Lie Behind the Lie Detector. It's from a website called antipolygraph.org. It's a manual. It's a free ebook, but
he reached out to us after we did the polygraph episode, trying to get that we missed the mark with the Florida Action Committee call we did. He said we missed the mark.
A little bit. I think that once people read that and can learn to identify what these control questions are, it makes the polygraph completely trivial. And I think the more people that do that, eventually they'll just stop giving it because everyone will know and they won't be able to have any kind of even pretend accuracy in it any longer.
So where do we go from there? So you have now, you've pled the Fifth and you got the stay from the Tenth Circuit. And what happens then?
Yeah, and so I got kicked out of treatment. They followed through on their promise. They terminated me. They said he's not amenable to treatment because he won't follow. At the time, the Colorado's requirements required a 6 history polygraph. And so they kicked me out. A probation officer, you know, was basically told that he can't violate me for it or that he could try, but it would be a very easy one on my part. And so he didn't. And so I was... a very dangerous, uncontrolled person out in the wild of Colorado while on supervised release without any kind of treatment or any kind of restrictions on me for a year and a half. And amazingly, I didn't go on a rampage and start causing havoc. I got a job and went back to school and had contact with my family. So, and then about a year or so later, the Tenth Circuit issued their opinion in my favor. And magically at that point, the same treatment provider I was going to changed their mind and said, oh, yeah, we'll welcome him back now that they know. And so the same one that terminated me for being not amenable to treatment invited me back. And my PO said, you have to go to him. And I did end up completing treatment through them. And it was a better experience the second time around.
So you were magically amenable after they had yes. the treatment. Amazing.
So Larry, give me the scope. 10th Circuit only applies to Colorado. It applies to the entire 57 states that we have.
It only applies to the states within that circuit. But if you're not in that circuit, being that it was well pled, well argued, well researched, you can cite to it. If you're in Alabama, even the 11th Circuit, you can say, this is very persuasive.
And to what degree does persuasive matter? Does it just like nudge it along? Is it like, wow, that's really significant?
Well, when an appellate court is looking at something, they're looking at what already exists in case law from the Supreme Court, because the Court of Appeals is only one notch below. So they're looking for the Supreme Court. There is nothing from the Supreme Court on this in terms of his particulars. So then it's a matter of first impression for the Court of Appeals. So rather than starting out from scratch, another appellate court, if they're inclined to want to be objective, they're going to look at the Tenth Circuit and say, what did they do? So although they're not bound by it, they're going to be very intrigued by it. And so it has been helpful around the country. You know, it's helped in West Virginia, the state Supreme Court. You remember that? I don't remember the name of the case, but they said, I believe it was West Virginia. But yeah, there's other states, even not in that circuit, that have said, yes, we agree with this analysis. So it can be very persuasive if they're inclined. If they're inclined not to give any relief, they'll be dismissive. But if they're inclined to be objective, they'll say this is well done, and it was well done.
And I can't cite the case, but I don't have it memorized. But I'm almost completely sure the Ninth Circuit has reached the same conclusion as well.
So,
and did this now launch you into getting off the registry and having a perfectly easy going life?
Oh yeah, it's been smooth sailing from there. No, I mean, it would certainly helped, and I'm glad that, I fought the battle, so to speak. We ended up going back into treatment and, completed that and was fortunate that I had a relatively short term of supervised release compared to some other people, but,
Larry, is this an example of impact litigation?
It very much, this is exactly impact litigation. His case has impact well beyond him. It is precedential, meaning the Tenth Circuit. If you're in the Tenth Circuit and you have very similar facts, you're likely to get the same result no matter what state you're in. And so, yes, this is what we do at NARSOL. This is impact litigation. So that's what our next segment is hopefully going to be about in terms of the mail policy. Not the mail policy. That's what happens when I get
email?
Late at night. The email policy, but similar to mail, but not. So,
in the last little sliver of your life, you've been alive so long, you were around when they invented Pony Express.
We didn't even have ponies back then.
Right. So before ponies were even invented. So email has been a very small part of your existence. Whereas the rest of us, we've been using email the whole time we've been around, pretty much.
Yes. They, back in the Lincoln administration, they were beginning to use covered wagons and ponies. And so,
are we ready to go down that path? Or
yeah,
are...
let's do it. Brian, did you have anything else? We really are grateful to have you here in Houston. And thanks to one of our patrons, they helped make that happen. And
yes.
So it was very nice that the opportunity arose, and we took advantage of it.
And the individual that sponsored your participation here, he miraculously fell off a ladder. Or unfortunately, I don't want to say miraculously. He unfortunately fell off a ladder sometime earlier in the week, and he was excited about coming. He was going to fly in Friday night. I was going to introduce you guys, and he's not here because he fell off a ladder. He's somewhat of a clumsy, super hardworking individual, but it was over the top generous that he would try to sponsor someone and bring them out here. Thank you. I'm glad you're here.
Really appreciate that, and thank you guys as well.
Cool. Appreciate you coming along.
Kudos. Seriously. So, okay.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
Now, what is this crap that you've brought about Corlicks?
Well, we have another guest.
We do? I don't know who's coming up for Corlicks. So. Oh, you are in your... Do you want to use a real name or a fake name?
I can use my real first name.
That's fine. I'm totally okay.
It's active, so you always want to be careful. There's active litigation going on.
Okay, yeah. So you are...
You can use any name you want.
I know, if you want me to call you Deborah.
No, that's right. My name is
Hannah. Welcome, Hannah.
My real name.
And what are we going to talk about?
Hannah, tell us about
the
issue.
I don't profess to be an expert. We have an ongoing case with my loved one. And one of the things that you find out real quickly is that deadlines are everything. And even involving extensions, which are common on both sides, both prosecution and defense, they're still important. And even good cases can fail because of a deadline or an extension or missed paperwork. Sorry.
That's okay.
I get passionate.
Don't do it again.
All right.
I'll chop them off.
I'll try. I can't make any promises. I only have experience with the Bureau of Prisons.
Okay.
BOP is the term Bob. That people, lovingly refer to.
Great organization.
When you're working, active cases, whether it's appeals or, anything post-conviction related, or even, if you're being imprisoned and your case is ongoing, because it happens a lot, you're remanded before there's even a trial. There are, some prisons are better than others, just like anything, there are a lot of prisons where the BOP just makes their own rules, which is par for the course for a lot of people who fight cases that are, sexual in nature, any kind of sex offense, whether it's people in the registry or people who are about to be on the registry or any variation on a theme. And the BOP does not look very fondly on them. They're not an exception. And they are, second-class citizens even when they enter the prison system. And a lot of, especially internet-based sexual offenses, carry restrictions that usually don't take effect until after you've served your sentence, but the BOP, again, tends to make their own rules and has very little oversight and very little recourse, again, as do many of these offenses. And when timelines are important, it is even more important to be able to connect with your attorney, and it brings up a lot of civil rights issues for you not to be able to connect easily with your attorney or even your loved ones who might be acting as a third party intermediary with your attorney. So I'd like to bring light to the issue that there are several federal prisons and more than likely very state prisons as well that go go out of their way to make it more difficult and push things, you know, close to a deadline that's very important to someone's case, whether pre or post conviction. You know, you don't, if you have an internet restriction, the BOP says, okay, well, you can't use the internet. Well, a lot of these email systems like CoreLinks, they're not really connected to the internet, or if they are, it's only, it's a very restricted channel between you and the other person. And as many people probably know, when they're even, you know, using snail mail to communicate with their loved ones in prison, there is a process of, you know, approval that you have to go through to even be able to receive or send mail to an inmate. The same goes for internet. So for the BOP to go out of their way to make it more difficult for people to keep in touch with their loved ones or attorneys in a more immediate way than snail mail, because we all know how reliable that's been, especially in the last year and a half or 2 years.
So wait, you're telling me that your loved one inside is not allowed to use, like, the email system?
Because it was an internet-based case, and of course he was on the registry with a prior conviction before, so that adds all sorts of enhancements. The BOP has taken it upon themselves to enforce this. And again, I'm not an expert, so there might be legal gaps in my knowledge.
I'm trying to, so do they have full internet access inside?
No, they have no internet access.
And is the email list of the to's and froms, is that restricted? Or can he just email John Doe at yahoo.com?
He can't email anyone. There are some inmates.
But somebody that could, someone that had access.
Someone who could has to go through the same process that you would have to if you were to use snail mail. You would have to get that person's name and phone number and address or whatever, because everything's individual too, so each prison might have different rules, or there's an overarching BOP policy, but again, there's a lot of variation as depending on who's the warden and who's the staff or who shows up that day for work. So, you know, you're held to a different standard, not only being, you know, a registered person or just someone with a sex offense, but also if you have any kind of internet restrictions, even though you're not connected to the World Wide Web, internet is being used to transfer messages between one party and the next, and they are excluded from that, which further just cuts you off from the immediacy of being able to connect in a timely manner with attorneys.
So I'm going to assert some tech prowess here, and somebody here can probably back me up here a little bit. I believe that the email systems that are in place could filter everything word by word, and if either based on a specific word or even like with some kind of like machine learning stuff, you could kind of figure out intent of messages.
Well, nothing, not even phone conversations are anything but recorded and reviewed. You know, you can.
So if the person were, if you were allowed to email them and they said anything about breaking out, anything like sex related, they could flag them, I believe.
Of course.
Can you, Don, would you agree? So
I
like it. Just it doesn't even it makes zero sense to me as to why they would do it.
How much of these laws really make sense?
Very, very few of them. But I tried it. Larry says the law is very legal, and I'm like, bullshit. It's not. They may be often, but a lot of times then they're just knee jerk reactions and someone being a jerk. And this isn't law though. This is just someone's policy.
The term I use is the law is logical.
Well, the problem is,
I'm sorry.
Until the politicians screw it up. But but what I'm intrigued about on the points of this restriction, the podcast listeners know that I have been very generous to prison administrators. They have broad discretion in terms of privileges or that. They're privileges. And therefore, a privilege can be denied. But what intrigues me about this privilege being denied is if it's a blanket denial, like recreation, like going to the library. If you're in disciplinary segregation, you would not get to go to the library. You would not necessarily get your recreation time unless it was required by law. You would not have visitation. All these things can be denied. But a privilege like the communication through postal mail or through electronic mail, which is very highly regulated, I do not know how legally that can be done if it were challenged properly, because as she pointed out, it puts the person who has legitimate needs to access attorneys for deadlines and stuff at a disadvantage without a showing of anything. It's just an arbitrary policy that some administrator has decided upon. And so therefore, it troubles me greatly, and I get the letters all the time. So is that everyone with an internet base, because that's what they might say, is, well, it's only those who use the internet, or is it everyone with a sexual offense? Do you know, is there institutions that are that where they give them access? The particulars still escape me because the letters are hit and miss. I get letters from Arkansas saying that I can't do that from, there's a prison in Forest City, and then, you know, it's like, it's hit and miss. That,
well, take so. It a step further, too, just finding a notary, someone who's official enough to be able to sign off an affidavit that you need to get to an attorney here. Mm-hmm. Even that process is difficult, and not just for anyone with a sexual offense, but in general, it's already difficult. So you're taking, again, someone who's pushed way down to the on the totem pole of even a prison hierarchy, and the BOP employees take it as their special mission, which I'm going into a little bit more opinion than actual fact in that regard. But, you know, anything, it's not, you know, obviously the most egregious, in my opinion, is the internet restriction for something that is entirely monitored and entirely separate from what anyone here would consider actual internet access. But, you know, other things are required of people who are actively fighting their cases or actively appealing their cases or just trying to reach out to attorneys and experts who can help them in prison. You have a right to do that. That is part of the only thing that you have going for you when you've been convicted of a crime or pled to a crime. And as far as at least my experience with someone with a sexual offense, it is not possible, or it's barred, or if it is possible, it's at the last possible second where you are endangering yourself just in a simple matter of meeting a filing deadline or meeting a deadline, but your lawyer had to take out anything that you were participating in because he couldn't get that information in time. He couldn't consult with you. He couldn't do anything but, you know, wait and wait and wait. Or in my case, call every single day with the prison and get a different answer every single day and not be able to schedule because there's only one person in the entire BOP who's responsible at that particular location to sign off on an appointment. So it's a serious issue, and people should be not only aware of it, but it obviously that's a serious civil rights issue too.
Well, most people in federal prison are going to be internet-based crimes because it's going to be the possession and distribution of child porn, or it's going to be something with interstate, because otherwise it would be an intrastate thing. It would be in state court. So most of your federal people are going to have been traveling across state lines because they thought they were going to meet somebody that turned out to be an undercover sting. But your federal, your general sexual crimes, if it's not on an Indian reservation or if it's not somewhere where there's federal jurisdiction, they're going to be in state court. So I don't, what I'm trying to get at is everybody who has a sexual offense conviction, since they're so primarily internet based, can you be a sex offender in federal prison and have internet access through court links?
With an internet crime, I can guarantee no. I don't know.
Okay.
So I was in the BOP when they implemented court links. Mm-hmm. They gave discretion to each individual prison, to the warden, to ultimately decide. But the guidance they issued was that people who had contact or attempted contact with minors, which included all the sting operations, were not going to be allowed to have the access to the court link system. Whereas people who had internet-based crimes that didn't involve contact or communication were allowed to.
Well, there would be so few of those because, like I say, if you have a standard sex crime, you're going to be in state court. You have to have an interstate jurisdictional hook, which is the internet, primarily, or on Indian reservation, or on some federal, where there's federal jurisdiction. You can't come in the state of Texas and someone who's doesn't have, there's a limitation on jurisdiction.
Well, like the child pornography offenses, yeah, they were allowed to access the court link system.
Oh, really?
They didn't attempt to contact.
It's not internet-based. Okay. That helps clarify.
Larry, something interesting about internet-based crimes is the packets, like the traffic of the internet, has to go somewhere else first, which generally crosses state lines,
yes,
and then it comes back. So even if you're like emailing your neighbor, it may have had to go to Nebraska for you to email your neighbor in your neighborhood all the way across the other side. So now you've committed interstate travel. You've broken interstate jurisdiction.
So, well, you know, and the thing about the individual warden, I think we talked about it on the last episode, but the Bureau of Prisons was not created until 1930, which was like 70-something years after I was born. But prior to the Bureau of Prisons, we had a federal prison system, but each institution was funded by Congress line item by line item. So we had a couple of three prisons, and they were individually funded, and each warden was his own little fiefdom. But in 1930, they created the Bureau of Prisons. But still, it's a very decentralized. You have the administration arm in D.C., but these prisons are so far spread out that no one from the outside comes in and monitors them. So the warden and the administration are the kingpins. So they have broad latitude to run the institutions. I think anybody who's been in one would agree with that. You know, very few people coming from the outside. So the warden is still making up stuff as they go. And there's really not much you can do about that. You know, that's just the way prisons are. But anyway, so I think there's another question here.
Well, I was going to comment that I was in the federal system, and I was actually at Club Fed. And the Corlink system went in when I was in prison, too, and it was not run like you were saying there. But this has been 10 years ago, so I don't know what it's like there now. And I have to agree with Larry that it really is kind of up to the local administration. But we were treated pretty well there. But it was...
Well, keep in mind the security level.
Which was Club Fed for everybody who doesn't identify with that? Where is Club Fed?
Well, it's in a place here, just north of here.
The question is, I've heard they have salad bars. I've heard
sometimes. Yeah.
Seriously, sometimes salad bars?
Yeah, we ate good. I mean,
that's why it's called Club Fed. That's the joke.
That could well.
The security level is key in these issues too.
Well, it was
keep that in mind.
Low security institution. It was not it was a low security institution. People there were not scary. For the most part,
they're either at the end of their term or they, you know, pled out and were given a fairly light sentence comparative.
Well, I had 7 years.
Sure.
8 years.
Well, before we keep everybody here all night, there actually is a plan of action that we've been working on. Mostly our guest has been working on. She's been talking to Narsil's attorney. So, Hannah, tell us what the plan is, because I'm the coordinator, so I'm going to be also involved in this, but she's going to be exchanging. Just let her tell. What are we going to try to do?
Well, follow-up is necessary, obviously, but he was going to reach out to the Federal Public Defender's Office to see if at least my prison in particular was one where multiple complaints have been brought to the attention of at that level. Because, again, you know, there is a broad interpretation of policy at the BOP, and depending on the prison and depending on the security level, the warden does have a lot of leeway in how they, there's prisons where inmates with similar charges may not have to deal with the same restrictions or the same staff difficulty. But he plans to establish if there are multiple complaints for specific locations, because on an individual level, it's next to impossible to get any kind of relief. And I would go a step farther to say it could even endanger your inmate to do so. In some cases, you always want to make sure that you're in, you know, communication and keep that in mind as well. But it's easier to make civil rights claims if you have multiple instances of something with the same specific issue to approach it. So that is the avenue of attack, if there is one, at least in the short term.
So we may end up, when we have the 2025 conference, because litigation takes time. Mm-hmm. So we may end up by the 2025 conference talking about in great detail that we've been able to find this pattern and find a good cause of action, and it gains traction. And we're having another guest. If it's not Hannah, it's someone else who benefits from that work. And then
if there are listeners who have these same issues, speak up. So, email, contact, however you guys get in touch with that.
We'll share that. It's generally crackpot@gmail.com, and that goes straight to Larry. Pretty much that's how that works. It will be registrymatterscast@gmail.com. That's the email for the program. Well, thank you very much. Is this your first visit on a podcast?
Yes.
Awesome. You did fantastic.
And it's your first visit to a conference,
yes,
of this nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
And have you had a blast?
It's been a lot of fun. And a lot of emotional roller coaster. So
I gave her a hard time. She stayed at a B&B and didn't even stay here with us.
What? You did? Oh, it's probably because we're all creepy.
No, not at all.
That's what it is. Well, thank you so very much. Thank you so much. We'll see. Will we see you next year?
Yes. All right. Absolutely.
So she stayed at a B&B because she has particular travel needs like me. So we don't even have a picture of my shower.
I was going to ask you, did you bring your shower head?
Yes, it's been installed.
Do you guys know this story?
Well, but come up here, Brian. Tell us about shower heads.
I just remember from you talking about it.
Right, but what is your policy on shower heads? Do you believe that there's legitimacy for needing?
After hearing you talk about it, when I traveled to New York, I don't know, a year and a half ago, I brought one with me.
This was a running joke.
But did you need it because of low water flow?
Yes. Yes. I used it because I was going to be there for a while, and I wanted, you know, showers like I was used to.
Yeah, so I have a need for strong water flow, and the little trickle that comes down is not enough. So I install my own shower head, and I put theirs back when I leave. I think everybody should do that.
And when you travel, this was a running joke. I mean, like, somewhere around episode 50, there's a picture of a shower kit. So you actually have to carry, like, a separate trunk with you that has a pipe wrench, plumber's tape. Do you carry a plumber with you by chance?
Well, all you need to carry is channel locks, the shower head, plumbing tape, and you've got it.
And have you ever damaged anything to where you, like, now all of a sudden there's a water leak?
Well, not to my knowledge.
Yes, now you're having a polygraph, and I'm going to ask you these questions.
But it's the first thing I check is water flow.
I don't think you haven't done that here, because that's
I have done it here.
I was pretty impressed. It's a nice big fat shower head.
You should go up to the room and take a picture.
I'm not going anywhere near your room. Not, no.
But it was a great wide flow of water, but there was no water coming.
That's because you're on the 10th floor. It takes a lot of effort to get water up that high. Do you want to come join us? You don't have to. I can just open up the floor to questions.
Why the hell am I sitting down here if I'm not going to join you?
Because you're drinking?
Too late. I've been drinking.
Oh, you've been drinking. So there was a presentation done yesterday by a woman named Kathleen. And yes. You have joined us. And we met talking about meatballs.
Meatballs.
Friday night.
Yes, we did. Man.
No, that was Thursday night even. Sorry.
Ooh, it was.
And, there was a problem with the meatballs at the meet and greet.
It wasn't a problem.
It was some sort of special needs.
I don't want to eat any of... Oh, there's meatballs. That is exactly what happened.
What did you... You did a presentation yesterday that... honestly, like, how many times have you done the presentation? Exactly. Wait, I'm sorry. The listeners can't hear you.
It was the only time I did the presentation, although I've got to say I've been working on it a long freaking time.
Okay.
As my coworkers could tell you.
I got to tell you, it was incredibly well done.
Thank you.
And give us the elevator pitch, 30 seconds, something like that. What was the presentation about?
The presentation is about protesting law enforcement agencies from using police proactive stings versus actually gumshoe handling reactive cases of sexual assault.
Larry has brought up the stings from the context of that there's not even a victim on the other side.
Correct.
And so that's what this is related to?
It is.
We've had a number of conversations about it where if you do end up in a chat room and it is really a 13-year-old, you're screwed. Because that's what the vigilante on that other show, they were actually getting minors to do the chatting. That's what he was claiming.
I've never seen it done that way. It always starts as an adult, and then they morph to a minor.
But what you were describing is the profiles are created with adult pictures.
Correct.
Is that right?
In my son's case, he was sent the picture of a 24-year-old.
And how long through the conversation did it stay an adult before it flipped?
No. So the ad itself, the profile, and this was on Craigslist, it did not state an age at all.
Okay.
And quickly within the conversation, this person professed to be 13, and my son scoffed it off. Why would you be on an adult dating site if you're 13? You mean 23.
Okay.
That is exactly what my son said. She did not verify or not verify. He asked for a picture, was sent the picture of a 24-year-old. Along they move.
And how long does it then, like, what happens next? Does he then go meet?
Eventually, he does go to the address. He texts her, says, "I'm here. Would you come outside, please?" Because he's still a little is this a child? I don't think this is a child. Is this a child? She comes outside. She is the woman from the picture. She is an adult. He walks inside, and he is arrested for attempted rape of a child.
What child?
No child.
No child.
No child.
So I guess the only, the only crime then is that it was stated to be a minor.
That's it.
And then the continued chat, but
nope, nothing.
Larry, your turn.
That happens all the time, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
But how does that even exist as that? That sounds like entrapment.
It is entrapment.
Well, they say it isn't.
Okay, and you're going to say something to the effect of they can do it until they're told to stop.
Well, I think sometimes they do it after they're told to stop. but the way the statutes are often drawn, and they're drawn at the instigation of the victim's advocates and law enforcement because they want to have successful sting operations. So they draw the statute, constructed in such a way it says a person, a minor, or anyone who is represented to be a minor. And
it could be a cartoon image of a child. So, yes?
So you show up, but see the conversation, the 24 has the advantage because they know what they're attempting to do, which is to make an arrest caller. And so they have the advantage, and they can shame you, they can manipulate you, they mm-hmm. can tease you, they can do all these things, and it's okay because entrapment is only when they provide, and it's a real fine line, juries don't like it when you put it forth as a defense. We try it and it fails every single time. But the entrapment is when you never have any interest in committing a crime, and the law enforcement officer says, hey, I've got this great idea. If we do this, the result will be a gain of whatever. You know, we're gonna put together a scam to take all the money out of the vault. And you never thought about the vault, but you become tempted. Well, the juries don't like that defense because they say, well, when they told you you're 13, you must have been predisposed to have a crime or you would have stopped. So therefore, you had the predisposition, so there was no entrapment. The officer just merely was the fortunate barrier between you being able to act on your impulses, and we're fortunate, and thank God that operation went. But see, the thing, that operation was not needed because the person wasn't looking for sex. They were on an adult chat room. They had no desire to talk to a minor. Mm-hmm. They created an imaginary victim. I hate to tell you, when you're as old as we are, minors don't want to have anything to do with us. Yeah, they really don't. They're looking for, if they have anything to do with you, it's only because you can get them alcohol. It's because you can do something, but they're not interested in your sex. You know, you watch these things with Chris Hansen, and you see these guys that are 300 pounds and 45, 50 years old, and they talking to this supposed to be a 14-year-old. Oh, you're so cute. They don't think you're cute. So, but sometimes our ego gets in the way, and like it did with me and the hotel. You know, I can't tell that story on the podcast, but I wants to know it privately.
Okay, I want to know.
Maybe a Patreon extra.
Oh.
You have a question?
So what I wanted to bring up was the way they get around entrapment is they say, well, we just post online, and they act like they just post as a regular teenager, just casually hanging out. And they say, we don't reach out to the men. We let them reach out to us. What they don't tell the public is that they created an adult dating profile, or they posted an ad for men to reach out to them. So that's how they're saying, well, no, they're the ones that reached out to us. We weren't the ones reaching out to them. Yeah, but you were the ones asking for the men to reach out to you. And then the second thing they use is they get the men engaged in sexual conversation. Well, a lot of people use adult dating platforms to engage in sexual fantasy talk. That's why they're using these adult dating platforms, because they know they can easily get the men to play along. And then the third thing is, well, they showed up. So they use showing up as that shows intent that they wanted to have sex with the minor. So they would have raped the minor. We are heroes that stopped them from raping the minor. Showing up does not prove that they had intent to rape a minor, because men are showing up for different reasons. And actually wanting to have sex with a minor, or was going to try to have sex with a minor, is actually very few of them that turns out to be the reason.
Larry, help me understand. If we were to equate this to going to a bar, and upon entry, they check your ID.
Yes.
However, some people show up there with fake IDs. But you have a reasonable expectation that everyone there is above 18, 21. I don't care whatever age it is. and you go into the bathroom and you have relations with someone, and then they turn out to not be. But you had, that's a reasonable expectation that everyone got carded on the way in, that they have already pre-screened that everyone is of legal age.
Well, and
is this similar?
Yes, it's similar. Therein lies the problem. If you are in some of the states where they have what's called a strict liability statute, which is, I think, what he's wanting to talk about, Michigan on the Zach Anderson case. Anybody remember that case?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that was a strict liability offense. He traveled from Indiana across the border into Michigan, and it turned out that the person he had relations with was below the age of consent. And Michigan says, we don't care because it's strict liability. Knowledge, the legal term is spelled S-C-I-E-N-T-R, scienter. And there are statutory schemes all over the country that are devoid of any scienter, and they say, we don't care. I think they're unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has never said they're constitutional, but legislatures enact them anyway, and challenges always fail because there's a case with a Morissetti, I forget the other part of the party of Morissetti, but there's a case from 40, 50 years ago where there was a footnote, just a footnote, where the Supreme Court said, and some strict liability statutes have been upheld in the arena of sexual offenses, something to that effect. So everybody hangs their hat on the Morissetti exception. But the Supreme Court, when they have spoken on strict liability, they said that crimes that are going to have significant impact on your life you have to have knowledge that you're committing a crime. Something that strict liability would be like, not parking, but like speeding. There's no long-term, and you may pay higher insurance rates, but if you get a speeding ticket, you get 3 points on your record. It's a temporary aberration. It goes away after a passage of time. But when you're talking about a sexual offense or even a felony offense, that's a lifetime-altering consequence. All those statutory schemes should have an element of scienter, and that's what the Supreme Court has said. But legislatures all over the country say, yep.
Remind me, I'm going to give you my definition. Strict liability is like you get a speeding ticket. Well, officer, I didn't know what the speed limit was. Sorry, ignorance of the law is no defense. So you're going 55, they don't change it to 35. You didn't see it change, but now it's 25, and they pull you over. You were expected to know. That's strict liability?
That's strict liability. And with small infractions and regulatory nature infractions, they're okay. Strict liability doesn't alter your life. Okay. Like I say, with a speeding ticket, 3 points come, 3 points go. But a felony doesn't come and go in most instances, in particular a sexual offense felony.
I received a message that says, but what about the minor that has a fake ID? There was no intent to commit a crime. Please define that term. That would go back to the bar.
That's what I was trying to describe. You would have a reasonable expectation, but in Michigan, they wouldn't care. They would say, well, the fact of the matter is, birth certificate says he or she was under the age. It's strict liability. And you say, but I didn't know she was in a bar. He was in a bar. I had an strict liability, that's what birth certificate says. That's wrong.
And the parallel is when you go to these dating websites, there's some sort of language that says you're over 18. Even there's some, I don't know what it's called, but there's something on the internet that they can't track information. Generally, under 13 can't even make profiles, like on Facebook. So they make a Facebook for kids kind of thing. So anywho, so you're at some adult website for meeting people. You're expected to be over 18 upon entry. Of course you can lie and just change the year of your birth to say that you're 175 years old and you're one of your classmates. And
so kind of off of that same remark, we have a woman in the audience who her brother was entrapped on Badoo, and they have facial recognition. So the of-age police officer had to get her.
Yeah.
But
she could have she could have used a picture of her mom. To pass.
I'm not sure how it works, but
right.
Theoretically, it has to be a person of age. So,
yeah, sure.
I mean, how could you possibly then ever date anybody? How could you meet anybody on the internet?
I have no answers for any of these questions.
Well, I don't know how you could actually even have a physical relationship with
Correct.
Strict liability, because I hate to tell folks, people mature very young, they develop physically very young, and so therefore, you would almost need to collect identification, photocopy it, and then have a signed. I mean, it's ridiculous.
And be able to spot fake IDs as if you're a bouncer.
Yes, you would.
At the club.
You'd almost need one of those fancy that I guess what you call it, a scanning machine where it reads it and they that you could
validate it.
Validate the ID.
Yeah.
You'd almost need all this stuff. I mean, how realistic is that?
Someone says you need to cut off the leg and count the rings. We're going to age people by like tree rings. That's clever. I like that. Very good. Very good. Your organization is what?
Citizens Against Government Entrapment, CAGE.
CAGE. Like CAGE. All right.
And they're in a cage.
Can you quickly tell me how people can find you? I would very much like to have you on again, and we're running short on time. I was super impressed and wanted to bring you
on. Thank you. So our website is cage.fyi.
Okay.
And cool. I also have a blog, ladyjusticemyth.blog, which you can reach me off of that as well.
Excellent. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And kick rocks. Thanks. Is there anything else that you want to talk about?
I'm exhausted, but we can take questions if there are any, because you guys have stayed with us. So what?
If you have a question. So look, here's the deal. This microphone, it rejects you people and listens to us. So if you want to come up and ask a question, please come up along the side. You can even sit down in the chair. And please, 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 you're coming back. And that's totally fine. Are we going to talk about the same subject?
You're probably tired of hearing from me, but I have a lot to say. I'm going back to the polygraphs.
Okay.
Okay, so I have heard that in polygraphs, you're not supposed to ask more than one or two questions. And you're supposed to ask the same question in more than two ways in order to get accurate results or close to accurate results. Do you know anything about that, or have you heard anything about that?
So the question would be, are you over 24 and then are you under 26? Is that sort of the way?
No, because you'd have to be, it'd be like, are you 24? Were you born in whatever year?
That's fine. Okay.
So you ask the same question in two different ways to get the same answer. And that's the way polygraphs are supposed to be conducted. But from what I'm hearing, especially from his, there are multiple questions being asked. So that, from what I know about polygraphs, that automatically is no good.
Like,
the polygraph is not going to work because you ask multiple questions, not just one question. Do you know anything about that?
Our polygraph expert, Brian.
you hit it dead on. The National Polygraph Association, I don't know if that's their actual name, but there is a National Association of Polygraphers, and they've issued guidance, and they show in their studies that they show the polygraph is real and reliable. In those studies, they talk about a specific issue, polygraph exam. And that is the question where, did you commit this crime? Did you steal from the store? Whatever. And in specific issue polygraph examinations, their guidelines say to limit it to one to two questions, and to ask those questions in multiple ways. In sex offender treatment, they rarely do specific issue polygraph exams. Sometimes they'll do them to, if the person says they were innocent of the crime, they will use a specific issue polygraph exam to ask them, you know, did you really do it, and, you know, a minimal treatment kind of stuff. But the majority of the maintenance exams are not specific issue. They ask four or five relevant questions. And the Polygrapher Association has expanded that magically to say, okay, well, that's okay. It's not quite as reliable, but still really, really good. And they say you're supposed to limit to, I think, 3 to 5 relevant questions.
Did you guys hear that Texas just passed a law that says polygraphers no longer have to be licensed? What do you think about that? I think that's crazy.
Okay, how should we have licensed magicians? Should we have licensed smoke and mirrors performers? It's such bullshit. I got yelled at when we were doing that polygraph program on my disdain for them, for the level of disdain that I have for them. Someone was like, "Cool it. We know you think it's a kabuki machine." And so I'm trying to refrain from. Someone said to me on our social networking site, "Well, what about real magic?" I was like, "There's no such thing as magic. So what is real magic? So there's not real lie detectors or real, like, it's just such."
I think we should be the polygraphers. We should start doing it because you no longer have to be licensed in Texas
Perfect.
To do this. So I think I'm going to become one of those.
Why don't the people that are a step or two removed from the person, so obviously, like, I can become the polygrapher. Why don't one of you people become a polygrapher and go take money from people?
Why not?
Because that's what it is. It's complete sham.
Yes.
Any other questions from anybody? Anybody? I do want to make sure to acknowledge and thank everyone so very much. Really appreciate you coming and hanging out. It really means a lot. It's a lot of fun. This is 197 episodes. Larry, like in a week and a half, 2 weeks? We move into year number 5 and we cross 200 episodes.
Awesome.
I've been putting up with you for like 7 years.
And how long does a typical podcast last?
They're usually like an hour and 10, and we're at 119.
No, I'm talking about the length of the life of a podcast.
I mean, you can go back and listen to episode 1.
Oh, the person who starts a podcast.
Mean that. The average age is 7 episodes.
So we have exceeded the 7.
By a little bit, Any other questions from anybody? Anybody? Bueller? Anyone? Bueller?
Thank you.
Thank you guys so very much. I really appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of the conference. Safe travels home.
You've been listening to FYP.